A warm welcome to you this mid-May episode of The Cyber Show. Today, we're going to be hearing from one of the leading lights in advanced music technology. Rob Thomas is a different kind of electronic music producer, having pioneered a completely different kind of music, which is highly reactive. Maybe you've never heard of reactive music, and you won't find it on Spotify. But if you play games, you're probably already a big fan without even knowing it. Reactive music is never quite the same twice, always changing, adapting to what you do or even what you think. It's music that's really code running on your computer. Rob Thomas has been crafting it for almost 20 years, and in that time, he's worked with an all-star lineup from Massive Attack and Imogen Heap to Hans Zimmer and Brian Eno. Long before the current AI craze, Rob was making music with neural networks, Markov chains, and genetic algorithms, and so he brings a unique perspective to concerns over AI and art. Should AI replace musicians, composers, and producers? Will it create amazing new music, better than anything you've ever heard before? Or will it descend into the ever more bland swamp of uniform and boring dirge? Andy's worked in the studio with Rob's on project going back to 2008 and recently caught up with him for a chat.
Rob, just kind of give the listeners a little bit of
give a bit of a breakdown of my crazy journey with music.
That would be cool.
I always try and summarize it as, I started out as a musician and a composer, and I was doing what most people do with music, which was playing in bands, and then eventually, as I started becoming professional with it, making music for advertising, radio, video games, so media-type music. But very quickly, as I started to do that, I kind of went what I say now is going off the tracks. So basically started breaking the rules of what you can do with linear music, so music that has a fixed state, as in a wax cylinder is a piece of linear music, a piece of vinyl is a linear music, a CD, an MP3, and even a Spotify stream are all conceptually the same thing. They just start, they play the same for every single person that hears it every single time. And I quite quickly started to go outside of that and to try and do non-linear music, which has got many different forms. The area where that takes place the most in culture at the moment is in video games. So you'll have the music which is responding to the player in some way and adapting in real time as they're doing different things in the video game. But a lot of the projects that I did were exploring outside of that. So instead of responding to a player in a video game, it would be responding to you in your real life, in your real life situation in some way. So I worked with Andy a lot at around that time on many projects with a company, RJDJ, which was really innovative, a very early innovator in distributed adaptive and reactive music systems in the very beginning of the App Store. In fact, before the App Store existed on phones.
Everything that you have on your phone now, these guys invented, really. And it's such, you're giving such a modest and reasonable account there, Rob. When I first met you, you've got a degree in architecture and music and art and all sorts of things like that.
I think architecture was actually very important, because instead of going down the normal path with music, I studied a way of creating experiences, which is really what architecture is, which is non-linear. So you don't walk through a building the same way all of the time. You have to cater for the choices that people make as they move through a space.
I'm going to keep coming back to that again and again, because that is what you just said there is absolutely crucial to the conversation we're having. You anticipate and cater to the choices that people make. That is a really big thing, let's just remember that. So I mean, RJ DJ was a blast. Michael
Rydenbrooker, yeah.
I mean, he was our kind of crazy. What do we call him, Zarathustra? Because he would go up to the mountains and come down with a new vision. And Michael was a laugh to work for. And I felt RJ DJ was like the Bell Labs of the early kind of mobile technology scene. What was that? 2010.
2009.
Was it? Wow. Yeah. I mean, this is how the years have gone by. But, you know, we in 1 week kind of conjured up things that entire companies or entire industries are kind of made of now.
Yeah.
And it was the pace and the excitement of it. There was all sorts of people on that Shoreditch scene, weren't there, now that are doing very interesting things. And,
you know, you could even extend this to social media, although I don't think it was so innocent. But there was a very optimistic, innocent feeling around the beginning of mobile for a while, probably until kind of about 2012, where it did feel like there was a new type of computing interaction that was happening that was sort of more overlaid over reality, a little bit more like what we now think of as augmented reality and cross-reality experiences, because people were just out and about with phones. We didn't really know at that point how to sucker them into staring at their screen all of the time. That wasn't really established yet.
None of that was around. Heady days of optimism, and it was brilliant. Yeah. I wrote a lot about that in Digital Vegan, I think, of how just the passion that everybody put into that and the amazing futures that everybody saw long before surveillance capitalism, long before dark patterns, long before any of the dark forces had taken control of that.
Yeah, I mean, although I have to say that for me, one of the biggest things that I feel, although, you know, we were, I think, relatively innocent in the we were only doing musical experiences. It's sort of only music. Like I say, no, music very rarely kills people. But
do you remember that time? Sorry, do you remember that time when the PD patch that was like a augmented drum and bass that like went with your driving style? So you put the phone on the dashboard and then you started driving.
Well, that could kill someone, yeah.
And people were driving around like nutters.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of, driving's an interesting one. It's like, it definitely has some potential downsides.
That was a really strange thing to mix. And that was, you know, that was one of those interesting moments where I could see the warning signs, where I could see, hold on, what we're doing here has big implications. Another one was where the zombie game, and people were swiping their phones, and sometimes they were just hitting each other with their phones, and it was like, or smashing the screens, and we're, hold on, this is getting out of control. We're going to have to stop this.
Well, I think quite a lot of those ideas and projects still have positive potential in them, but you're right in saying that there are obvious dangers that come alongside of that. Say, you know, driving is a good one, because anything that might use music, if it was interactive, to stimulate you into doing something that you probably shouldn't be doing. So driving into another car is a pretty obvious example of that. But another example is a lot of the work that I've actually done since RJ DJ has been in making adaptive music systems and generative systems that revolve around health and functional music in some way. So interactive system might help you to do some health exercise, some aspect of healthy exercise, which would improve your health.
You've really redeemed yourself.
But, you know, so for instance, that's an example, just to explain it a bit, might be that you wear an EEG headset, which will read your brain waves as you're meditating. So you might be wanting to learn how to meditate and calm your mind. And of course, it's very hard for somebody to watch you and say, oh, now you're meditating. No, you're not meditating. But with an EEG headset on, you can know that. But music can be very useful in, like, first of all, in inducing a meditative state, but also very subtly reporting back to the listener while they're meditating that they are actually meditating well and they should carry on doing what they're doing right now. So that system, for instance, you'd wear the headset and you'd listen, and the music system that we created would play meditative music to you. And as you are meditating, it would kind of go down in intensity and get calmer and calmer and calmer. And you would know as that was happening that you are indeed meditating well. If you started to lose your focus and start thinking about things and stuff was coming through your head, you would actually hear the music kind of get more active and you'd hear a little bell sound, which would basically say, calm your mind, think in the moment, you know, be in the moment again, and it would kind of go down again. So that's an example there where you could make a feedback system which is positive in people's lives, and could, you know, meditation, I think, is a powerful positive force in people's lives. But, you know, you could equally make a system like that reinforcing something very bad in people's
Absolutely, yeah. Where my hacker mind comes into this is that it takes a certain way of seeing things, slightly pessimistic things, a darker view, to say, okay, I can see how this technology could be used in a really bad way. I want it to be used in a good way, but I don't have control over that. Creating technology is like creating any piece of art. You release it and it's no longer, Khalil Gibran says, like about children, it's like you've released the arrow from your bow and it's at the mercy of the wind now, right? And I've had that experience. I mean, I'm no pacifist in that way, that, you know, I've worked on lots of defense stuff, but always with eyes wide open. But on this occasion, I was working on something that was in an adjacent field to defense, on a medical technology, only to find out later that it had been repurposed as a targeting system. And I was kind of really upset by that, because I'd never intended that technology to be used in that way, but I had no control over it, right? And that feels like a real betrayal.
This is one of the biggest challenges, which I think if you are ethically aware of what you're doing and you are trying to do things with technology, is the endless kind of impossible struggle to retain enough control over that to make sure that it remains ethically sound. I mean, even worse is that it doesn't inspire someone else to do something, which is, even if they're not using your actual code or your actual output, but inspiring something that, you know, could be really negative for society. Like, one example which comes back for me is that everything that's happening in AI and music at the moment, which is really, I refer to as not artificial intelligence, but automated imitation, is, you know, I've been asked many times by startups, oh, can't you just make a kind of universal generative music system that can just make infinite music in all of these styles for us? We don't want to pay artists. We don't want some human process in there. We just want to automate the lot.
And yeah, I think it's always okay to say no. And it's even better, it's always okay to say no, that would be unethical. I think a lot of smart people, well-educated people, developers and things have a real problem with saying no. Because there's
I think, yeah, it's also kind of like, no, it would be unethical, but also doing it with humans would be better. But there are other areas of why humans are so amazing from a musical creativity perspective that I actually can't explain, and even they can't explain. And that is something, I mean, I've been very lucky with how I've been exposed to really good creators, like really amazing musicians and composers.
We've worked with so many amazing artists. I was just thinking that through now. Obviously, before we were at Arjo DJ, I'd come from working with Massive and the drum and bass scene and all that kind of thing in Bristol. And then through the BBC, but at RJ DJ, we had all kinds of mad artists. You've worked with Hans Zimmer a lot. We had Cold Cut, Little Boots, Chemical Brothers, but a huge roster of names. But what I found common in all of those artists is all of these incredibly talented, creative people that we meet and work with have a sort of love-hate relationship with technology. They want it, but they don't want it. And what we would often bump into was people say, well, hey, can you do this, that, and the other thing? And we'd say, yeah, sure, you know, we can do anything. We're computer scientists, we're coders, we'll make it for you. And then they would kind of go, ooh, we don't really like that. And I think that all came to a head at the end of RJ DJ, when we kind of realised that reactive music wasn't going to work in the way that we all thought it was, because the labels didn't like it, because it wasn't a linear product that they could just sell. The artists found it very, very difficult to get their head around how to compose non-linearly. And even worse, the listeners wanted it and didn't want it at the same time. There's a real conflicted ambivalence around lots of technology, where they go, yeah, that would be amazing, that would be so cool. And they try it, and after a few times they go, oh, I kind of don't like the fact that it's not the same every time. Yeah, I want to go back to my nunu, my familiar sort of songs from my childhood or whatever. Do you agree with that?
There's many things that are in there that unpacking what you're just talking about, which are different challenges of going beyond what normal recorded music is, distributed musical experiences, which we now only really do as recordings, even though they're streams, they're still just recordings. And I think what those different points relate to are different aspects of the content creation pipeline of music, if we talk about it like that. So the making of music, the composition, production, recording, creation of the musical experience, that's all with the artist, and the, most importantly, the tools that those artists use. There's many problems in that area which are unresolved, but the question is, why are they unresolved, and what work needs to be done to move that forward, and why that work isn't being done? So those are some questions in that bit. Then there's the next bit, I think, is distribution of music. So when music goes away from the artist out into society, how does that happen? Who is in control of that? And also, there's many things in there which are not replicated in any way for things that go beyond linear music. So, you know, we went from records and CDs, which were amplified in various ways through radio, to streaming, which has now been amplified in various ways through social media and playlists, which are controlled by newsfeed algorithms, personalization algorithms effectively, which are highly controlled by proprietary systems by very powerful people. And then the last part of it, which is, I think, is also really interesting, is the experience of music and how that can evolve. I think what I would say is that of all of the things that we were exploring at RJDJ, there were some aspects of those experiences which were extremely successful, considering that they were normally just one bit of music, or at the most one album of music. And, you know, one bit of music or one album of music, especially in the world of streaming music, has extremely high listener fatigue. It is very, very unlikely to be listened to for very long. Regardless of what the form of that experience is, whether it's linear or non-linear. So the pool of experience inside of non-linear music is extremely small. It's tiny, absolutely tiny. So it's no wonder that people fatigued of that very quickly compared to what they can get from a $9.99 subscription to all of music from Spotify. So I think that there are challenges in all of those three areas. So the last one, experience, I think, many of the projects that we worked on, especially, you know, the one with Hans and Chris Nolan for Inception, is an example of something that was really, truly virally successful. So that, you know, that went to number one in the App Store, had millions of people downloading it. And
the Dreamscape one, wasn't it? The Dreamscape.
Yeah, so that was effectively kind of
Inception.
Yeah, it was the culmination, really, of all of the work of RJDJ up until that point. Many, many concepts were embodied into that app. And what that project did is that it was an app that detected what was going on in your life. So it worked out the context of the listener. So that might be that they were in a quiet space or a loud space, or they'd be sitting down, or they're walking along, or they might be running down the street, or they might be on the train going like fast through the countryside, or it might be sunny weather, or it might be raining, it might be full moon.
And we pulled in all that telemetry, didn't we? We pulled in so much stuff to contextualize the listening point and the sort of potential mental state of the listener.
So then it sort of says, well, you're in this situation, you're traveling on a train, so we put you into the traveling dream, where, you know, the movie Inception's all about dreams, and it made a soundtrack to your life at that moment. So, you know, there's other startups that are exploring this now, but you know, this was 10 years ahead of that, at least.
We were always a decade ahead of what was going on. But, you know, when I look at it now, you know, as a cybersecurity practitioner, that scares the bejesus out of me. And I think, well, you know, if I sat down now with the requirements spec and someone was going through, yeah, we're going to build this app and it's going to, like, pull in this telemetry, it's going to take the time of day, it's going to get the read the barometer, feel the air pressure, I'm like, no. This is just, like, way too much stuff that there's no way you're going to be able to get access to that data. And I don't believe that you should. I think it would be very, very dangerous. What's your cybersecurity framework for this app? You know, where, how are you encrypting your data? How are you anonymizing it? And so on. You know, but we were just riding the wave of fun back then, weren't we? And it's sad in a way, because all of that stuff was so pregnant with possibility.
It is. I mean, it's I think it's, the question is that, you know, doing that, this is why are you doing it? Yeah, so that's like, what is the benefit of doing it? Is the question that if it was justifies, and you were doing it in a way that satisfied all of your concerns there, for instance, does that benefit justify the risk of doing that? And then, you know, for instance, is any of that information ever leaving the device at all? And, you know, this is, for instance, one thing that I was talking about a lot with the massive attack guys. How do we do that and nothing leaves the device? Because I think that's at least a perspective, which is, you know, not pumping loads of that stuff up into the cloud. So you're sort of at least trying to sort of make a way of doing that, which is respectful to that, to those concerns. But the bigger question, I think, is like, why are you doing it and what benefit does that actually have? And when you get to the functional sort of use of music rather than purely entertainment or art, if you were thinking about these systems more from a more functional perspective, which might have a more practical and easily describable, tangible benefit in people's lives, then I think that maybe becomes part of that equation that you need to think about. And, you know, if you are continuing to use technology and develop these experiences and you are dealing with sensitive information like that, then, you know, why are you doing it? Is that really worth doing, taking that risk for?
Yeah. Kind of goes nicely into the next point about why some of these projects succeeded or failed. That risk benefit analysis, times have changed. We saw the benefits as being spiritual. Music's always a good thing. I love that Kurt Vonnegut thing, that music is so beneficial to human beings that even as a pacifist, a military brass band brings a smile to my face. And we always think music is beyond reproach. And I still believe that. I still think music is, it's the food of love and humanity. What went wrong? Surveillance capitalism went wrong. The leverage, the instrumental leverage of people's interests as a way to surveil them, to categorize them, to predict their behaviors, and ultimately to sell them stuff. And if you're going to sell that data to governments, then to snoop into people's lives for governance reasons. But the whole thing just became snowballed into, when were we talking, 2008 and now, what we've seen in our careers working in the area is a catastrophic corruption of what technology is used for. It was a playground that we were in the days around RJDJ. We were in a playground, and I think we were actually, without realizing it, we're in the last days of very benevolent, fun technology that was innocent. Now I would not build products like that. I just think that the people are too vulnerable, and I think you're playing with really big data leaks and potentially, you know, putting them at risk. So I find that a lot of the failure of that, it wasn't our fault, maybe as developers and artists, that the ideas were unsound. It's just that culture was going against us. That technology was always going to be misappropriated for bad things. That's why, as I say, that's why we can't have nice things. Live is the one thing that's kind of kept its head while everything else turns to chaos, because it's a bit of a constant, isn't it? There's still a very vibrant, very good live scene. In fact, most artists make their money, if they're good, talented artists, they can still eke out a living on the live scene. And technology's done a lot to make that good, to make that better, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's, it's always been there, it will always be there, but it's always within the realms of what the artist can physically do. Like, it's always been where they can go and when they are still alive and all of these types of things, which is great, and that will always be there. But recorded music used to be this way of getting reach and sort of reaching way more people. I think that that has been eroded, where it doesn't really work for people anymore as a medium.
Yeah, that's a very interesting remark. I mean, so people of the last kind of couple of generations think of music as being the music industry, and the music industry really is the recording industry, although there's a music, yes, there's a music technology industry of synthesizers and gadgets that kind of goes behind that, amplifiers and so on. But, you know, the recording industry, you have to see historically as distinct from music as a project, came along, you know, in the, you know, turn of the last century, and became so dominant in its capacity to extend music in space and in time, and initially in time, because the point was that you could listen back to things. But then, you know, when you mix that with broadcast, with radio and recording, music becomes delocalized from the artist into a much bigger universe. And I really hear what you're saying, that where we've ended up through technology and now with AI, which we'll just get, we need to get onto, really, is that that has worked against everything that was built between about sort of like 1920 and 2020 has gone through, as all things do, you know, it's a natural process, a kind of climax and then a reversal. We're right back at the nadir, in a way, of the technology amplifies reach, because in order to have reach, you have to have interest. And if people aren't interested in it, if they don't care because it's undifferentiated from any other product, then, you know, what's the point?
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting way of seeing it, as a climax and then a decline. It's also that climax, maybe we could say people would have different aesthetic definitions of when that happened. But the climax of innovation and change in the recorded music industry probably was the beginning of digital recording, you know, and there's been many different changes in how we do digital recording and digital production since then. But what we effectively did was, you know, we made a way of doing recordings, first of all, and normally we just, you know, have a mic in front of a band in a room and say, do what you do live, and we're going to hit record.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then it kind of got to multi-track recording and Sgt. Pepper's, and the idea that the piece of music was beyond time and was reconstructed in the studio, with using the studio like an instrument in order to make something only possible in that paradigm. We haven't really moved on from that. What we've done in recorded music, in the conventional sense of the recorded music industry, has stuck with that and is still doing it now in 2024. It just happens to distribute it through streams instead of through bits of vinyl. So what I mean when I say that there are problems in the creation of music is to do with the lack of progression of the concepts and ideas of what it is that we can do with recorded music, because we've been able to go beyond recorded music for a very long time now. And, you know, the projects that we were exploring were doing that. But in order to make that successful, and to, you need a lot of exploration in it, not just what we've been doing, what other people have been doing over the last 20 years or whatever. You need way more exploration than that, orders of magnitude more exploration, by many, many people. So that means we need tools which are much, much more accessible for people to be able to do that type of work that goes beyond recorded music. So that was thinking in a much more non-linear way about the way that they're making music, but also how they're going to release that music and how that will be distributed. So that moves into problems in the distribution area, and how people will be listening to that music, and how that type of experience will be unique, you know, the unique things that they could explore, because there are so many things that we can explore beyond recorded music.
Of course.
We're just scratching the surface of it.
Yeah, yeah. that problem of distribution. And one of the things I remember from the kind of end days of RJZ Day, certainly, and then into sort of the Mojis era, was the thing of user-generated content and how problematic that was with the labels and the whole problem of intellectual property and the inability for people with very thin watches and briefcases and degrees in law to comprehend... to fit it into their existing boxes, to get the framework of understanding. I mean, it's the same with AI now. Intellectual property and generative content are not happy bedfellows at all. And what I think was one of the things that spoiled the party in the end was, I know Michael had a hell of a time trying to work with the labels and never really got anywhere because the labels kind of got it, but then they thought, oh, well, how do we distribute generative music? I mean, what does it even mean to distribute generative music, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that has evolved now in that there are models which people like Endel or different generative systems that are using in order to sell subscriptions, to instance, for generative music. So I think that there are ways that can be done, but it does not mean that the recorded music industry is ready to accept those, although, you know, Universal are involved with Endel, so there is progression there. And indeed, like, there was progression within the RJDJ timeframe on that as well. The very first apps were very, very difficult to do from that perspective, but later on, you know, after inception, there was, oh wow, okay, this kind of can work. But what I would say is that there is an entrenched attitude in the recorded music industry to try and make it work like it used to try and make it about selling record units.
And
there was an entrenched resistance, which still exists today in some areas, to not adopt models from more progressive industries like the video game industry, which has actually solved these problems. So the distribution of interactive content, which is effectively a video game, that's what it is, has got many different business models of how to sell that, how to get downloadable content in there, little bits of content you can buy within those things.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Inception, we already built all of those types of things into the experience. There were Easter eggs in there. There were special unlocks that you could only get in certain situations.
Yeah.
And all of that could easily be turned into a business model. But what you need is a lot of work in that area to make lots and lots of variety of experience for people.
We were on a very, very much a sort of gamified tip in that time, and one of the things I remember being quite successful, well, certainly I think like Matt Black, the Cold Cut, Ninja Jam, you know, we were doing some things like that a bit before that kind of fed into that. How would you describe it? The hybridized user was a creator listener. So it wasn't really clear to what extent you were participating in making the music versus how much you were listening to it. And so that very, very easy music production where you kind of had the feeling that you were making the music, but in fact, you were really collaborating and co-writing with the artist. That model seems to have had durability. I mean, certainly, is Matt still doing Ninja Jam? Is that still working?
I think that they've tried some reworks of that. I would say that I think the market of home producer, I would say, and that's a derogatory way of describing that, but non-professional user of music software, in both in the traditional way of working in a DAW, but well, also
I think the way to formalize it, Rob, is just to say that person does not intend to sell it commercially, so they're making it. They're making it for their own pleasure. I mean,
that's a way of saying. That is has been at least a huge market, and in many ways is much bigger than the market of recorded music. So I think that is a hugely, I mean, it is not as big as it was before the pandemic, but prior to the pandemic, it was a massively expanding business, and there was a huge amount of, you know, revenue from tools to make music with, guitar pedals, hardware, all this kind of gear that people are buying, which is bizarre to me that we're effectively fetishizing things that were special 20 years ago, where we have free software that we could be doing absolutely incredible things with that lots of people are not even aware of or looking at. So the that market, and I think what you're identifying there is like this sort of, yeah, like a collaboration between artists who are making content which is sort of people interacting inside of musically, but the idea of what is in their head when they're approaching it is, I am doing music now, I'm making music, I'm in, yeah, and doing something with music, rather than I am going out and listening now and going out of my life and doing some other stuff. So I think that model of being somehow doing music in some way, and now there are all these different tools, that's a hugely successful area. But I'm not sure that the area of, yeah, like music which is co-composed has been that successful. There are other projects like that, like an app called Playground. I don't think any of them have really been like, you know, super successful projects. They're kind of probably more traditional in a sense, in that they are somehow tapping into this idea that everyone can be an artist, and the artistic expression, yeah, through music. So it's a creative exercise, ultimately.
I like that, though. I do love that democratizing idea, you know, and where you can join in a sense.
That definitely leads on to AI.
It does. Okay, so I'll tell you what, how about we take a little break now, and then we'll come back and we'll deal with the elephant in the room, which is artificial intelligence. And I know you've got a lot to tell us about that.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
So I'm going to share my screen. You'll wince now as I open a Google Drive. Just don't look, Andy.
Yeah,
I'll tell you when you can open your eyes again.
Okay.
One of the things that I want to talk about really is the situation we're in with music, and, you know, the fact that there is basically loads and loads of music online as, you know, nicely labeled linear bits of audio that are pretty much easily scrapable and throwable into a model. So we've kind of got, you know, music's become easier and easier to create and put online. We've done that. Everyone has made tons of music and put it up there with loads of tags and descriptions.
Yeah.
Listening to music itself has become cheap or free with incredibly open access. So, you know, it's easy to access from, you know, bots and scrapers. And then there's a much bigger point, which is about music and culture has become homogenized. So I'll talk about that a little bit. And many musical idioms have become kind of cliches and entrenched over the years. We actually use that in a positive way sometimes in some of the functional music I do. So that it can be useful, but it also means that it's sort of, if you say I want dramatic, tense music, which is like an action sequence, then we kind of all have a shorthand of that in our head now. American understanding of when we say something like that, tense action sequence, and Chinese understanding when we say tense action sequence, and they align a lot more than they used to, really because of homogenization of globalized media. So, you know, until now, before AI, this has basically meant that musical skills have been devalued anyway. Musical listening has been devalued. Music's role in culture has been devalued. Music's role in society has been standardized. And music's meaning has been standardized. All of this is basically perfect for AI. You've sort of got a situation where there's a huge, well-labeled data set to train on. It's easy to access. It's easy to imitate because it's homogenized. Music, especially media music, has become simplified. This thing about understanding like what something means in music, I think maybe makes it easier to prompt from text, because our relationship between linguistic description and the end result is more standardized. And the homogenization across culture means that probably reaches further around the world. Anyway, this is trying to break it down a bit, but so I guess what I'm really saying is, in 1978, you know, you had film scores, for instance, that were basically incredibly expensive, but they were amazing, really slow to make, expensive to make, totally inflexible. So an example would be John Williams' score to Star Wars. Basically completely human made, quality was amazing. Yeah. And then you sort of had in the 90s technological augmentations of what humans could do made it cheaper, more convenient. You could do mock-ups of everything, more flexible, more generic. I would argue quality actually went down because of that. As technology has progressed now, that more and more augmentation has allowed for more convenience, more mock-ups, more flexibility, and that made things more generic and put loads of it online as well. So that is kind of that trend there to me shows that what we're doing with technology and augmentation is not really helping in terms of raising quality, but it's also meaning that automation of that stuff is easier. But it could be, and this is the sort of more positive angle, I would argue that we could be doing this. So now where we are, we've sort of got a massive amount of stuff that we've made with a combination of humans and technological augmentations. When I say that, I mean what we've done with DAWs, basically, and the process of making music. But we've dumped it all online, and now AI can imitate that. And, you know, when you look at Suno or Udio or those services, they're not there yet completely, but for a lot of media music, they are there. And, you know, I already know a lot of composers that are absolutely shitting it. But in the future, we could be staying ahead of what AI can do by doing more original and more capable things with, you know, new tools inside of the music creative process, but also that we could be doing other things with music that are more original than making linear music, that are not transparent and at least as easily scrapable and imitatable to AI systems. And if we were doing that, I think that that's a way that human creativity can always be ahead, because in order for AI to work, it needs loads and loads of examples of something which is effectively mainstreamized sort of thing by that point.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to say to musicians is, okay, we can do this, and we can, if we are using technology in this way, which is what we did at RJDJ, what people are doing in more ambitious projects with music and technology, it's possible for humans to kind of stay ahead, and it's possible for us to be doing individual, more unique, more exploratory, and I think much more exciting things with music. And it won't be so vulnerable as this way of working, where basically we're sort of slowly automating what we do, actually decreasing quality as we go along.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
I am being critical of where we have gone with music and technology, and my suggestions are to do things that are actually very hard and very ambitious. I will be kind of saying, well, maybe you shouldn't be just doing those easy things with music anymore. Maybe AI is forcing us to come to a point where we have to say, is it really good enough to do that and expect to make a living out of it, for instance? Maybe it's fine to do it if you don't expect to make a living out of it, because it's almost been bottomed out anyway by what we've done by other human creators.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe you're thinking about what is the role of human music creators in a professional context. It's like, well, what are you bringing to the table that is unique that AI can't do? You know, if it's just imitating a corpus of a massive amount of material that's very similar.
You know, I mean, just to give you the big picture of what's in my mind at the moment, this is the project of art. This is what always has always been the project of art, to escape the moment, to escape the milieu where we are. And what's happening is that it's getting harder and harder to get ahead of that, because our past is catching up with us constantly. It's being consolidated into these technological forms and automation, and it's like we've unleashed predators into the wild, which we now have to compete with, and so all the low-hanging fruit that we used to just go and enjoy picking, that's all gone, and you've got to climb up the tree so much higher just to get anything now. Just going back a couple of slides, let's just talk about quality. You know, quality is a very slippery and evasive word.
Yes.
You've kind of asserted there that the quality is going down. And I agree with you, you know, but I'm just going to say, you know, what your critics are going to see there is, well, yeah, by what measure are you defining quality? How do you know it's gone down? Surely, like in the 1980s, like quality of music went up, and people would say, we've never had more diverse sonic palette, we've never had more different methods of production at our fingertips, and both the quality of the tools and the quality of the product has arguably gone up.
Yeah, I would say, I would have the caveat, this is specifically talking about media composition, this slide. But I take your point, because this is sort of, I wouldn't apply this to pop music or non-media music, i.e. soundtracks.
Yeah.
Really. I would say that that's very diverse.
I mean, I watched the Eurovision last night, the night before, and... it was a fantastic spectacle. It was everything I hoped it would be. It was pyrotechnics, amazing graphics, beautiful makeup, beautiful people, incredible production values of you know, an international event like that. How you hold it together is just quite remarkable. Yeah. But there were there was no music in it. None yeah, whatsoever. No music whatsoever that I could relate to as music, and I certainly don't think there were any songs. But it's transformed. You know, it's transformed into a different kind of spectacle. And I think that, well, we talk about music, and we're labouring under lots of old labels and ideas of what music is. And in fact, what we're dealing with is utterly unrecognisable. From something that's on that timeline that you've got up there on your screen now, it's just not the same thing at all. It's like what was happening in the 1970s. So, it's almost like we're getting into apples and oranges territory. Even though there's a linear timeline there that you can trace the evolution of music, it's not the same thing at all now. So it kind of hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, what I was trying to relate it to here is the sort of change in workflow if you look at film scoring. So if you really, this should be called film and TV as an example, like a case study of how technology has changed an industry. This time, the 90s, is really the 90s, because it's down to the technology and the acceptance of the technology, synths and samplers, in making soundtracks for movies, because it was accepted because it did these things. It made it much more convenient, much cheaper. The directors and producers could hear what it was going to be like before they recorded anything. It's more flexible, but it had the effect to making things more generic. So if I would say, remove the word quality and use the word of an increase in genericism, that might be more solid.
It might, and also, you know, that kind of ties in with this theory. Well, I think it's a very accurate theory that you have, is that is the enabling principle for AI. That, you know, you've got this hugely homogenized culture. You can't really put a fag paper between the different bits of a genre now. They're just all of the same. And people's expectations align with that absolutely. In fact, if you did anything, you know, remotely kind of left field, people would just walk out of the cinema. So that's a massive cultural change, and you can't fight that. You can't reckon with it, because it's the foundation that's below everything else, the culture that you're kind of talking to and that you're operating within. And if that's
But this is the thing, though, I think, is that it's a very, like, why has it happened? And I wouldn't use the word whose fault is it. I would say who is involved in that change? And I think it's about how technology has been used in the industry, in this industry, but it's also how the people who benefited from those changes, mainly in terms of efficiency and predictability and risk reduction. Reduction is the biggest one. How they chose to maximize that risk reduction over more risky artistic exploration. And that has happened relentlessly over the last 20 years, especially since 2000.
That's a feature not of media. That's a feature of every aspect of modern life.
Yeah. No,
I mean, it's happened in code. If you look at applications, I mean, what I'm dealing with on a day-to-day basis in cybersecurity is exactly the same kind of thing, where, you know, quality is as low as the market will take. You know.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
It's as low as it can possibly be without, like, literally bloody revolution and revolt.
I mean, that's like many startups will have what they call, you know, their backlog, or features, which is not features, it's bugs. And bugs and features all mixed up, and the scores of how high things are on that backlog towards, we have to deal with it right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, and loads of those things are only going up there when enough people have complained about it that they're going to leave and stop their subscription.
Yeah.
So it's like, we all know, like, massive amount of shit that's happened in tech like that. And it's just like, oh, well, we just try out all of this shit. It doesn't matter if it's broken. If they put up with it, then great. And they love this feature over here. We'll just keep making that stuff and forget about fixing all this. So it's, I totally agree. I mean, it's the same kind of thing, I think, is in, it does affect music because that echoes through the culture, you know?
A triumph of mediocrity.
Yes.
Like, you know, the lowest common denominator is exalted into the highest position, and that's the effect of capital, is to drive quality down as low as the market can bear it. And AI is merely another stage in that, in the expression of that.
I mean, this was happening anyway. AI is just going to make it accelerate.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, it's kind of, we were doing this anyway. This is almost like forcing a reckoning to me. It's sort of like saying, well, something was going down to zero and now this is just making it crash.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
That's a very, very good phrase. Let's stick with that for a moment, Rob, because you say, you know, it's forcing a reckoning. It's always good when you analyze different curves, different trajectories, you're looking at a system and seeing where it's heading, is to say, well, what's the end game for it? What does that look like if you extrapolate everything into the future? Let's kind of imagine some scenario. So you have some box in your house that can just generate any kind of music. Or, you know, if you're a film producer, then you just have this, you know, thing, app on your phone that you just tell it, yeah, I need a tension bed for, you know, this scene. And it looks at the scene and it produces it. But, you know, it's absolutely anodyne. It's this milk toast, absolute mediocrity. But it's acceptable. And it's acceptable to the audience. But the audience eventually, I guess, what happens is they take less and less interest in a, there's nothing outstanding about any art form to remark about or to feel emotional about or feel good about. So it's like a gravitational collapse, like a black hole of mediocrity that just kind of implodes and sucks culture in with it. I mean, that's
it's
kind
of
the horror
mass of shit.
That's the kind of horror scenario that I see, and I see, you know, in that scenario, you know, $1 billion industries dying over the space of a year.
This girl won't love you. She'll never even look at you. You don't stand a chance because you're no good. You don't have what you need to have, and for this, you suffer. Because you haven't bought our product. You just cannot ever be happy unless you buy it right now and become better. Advance to popularity. All from the comfort of your armchair. So attractive, so sublime, so subscribe. Subscribe and rate higher on our Gullible Index. With a high Gullible rating, we can sell on your personal details at a premium to other advertisers.
I'm so happy since I bought this.
Buy and subscribe today.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
sometimes it feels like the world is like just carrying on as if this trajectory that music is on is not on that, and we can somehow just reverse it back to where it used to be. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And I think my gaslit feeling is sort of like, well, it's not that. It hasn't been that for ages. So we need to do something else.
There are lots and lots of stakeholders in this game.
Yeah.
And I think that we see it from, you know, if you see it from an artist's perspective, you can feel very gaslit. Don't forget that there are audiences and very diverse audiences in different age groups. There are radio DJs, there are film producers, there are people that run record companies, and they've all got a different slice, they've all got a different view on it. I think generally none of them want to see what they love disappear.
Yeah.
They perceive a threat, and it is a very real threat, and it's a threat of this black hole of mediocrity that comes out of capital. But in a way, if people don't want it to happen, it won't happen. So there has to be a sense in which people are willing this into existence.
Yeah.
There's a certain kind of masochism and anti-humanism in society. It's a self-hatred which brings people to this sort of very dark place of sort of wishing away everything good in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, what it comes down to for me as well is it the role, people like us who have been trying to explore this, should we be taking on the responsibility of trying to show a bright and positive path out of all of this stuff, yeah? Mm. So that we are lighting up a way that is exciting and really, you know, opportunity for people with music that is going somewhere different and positive and doesn't fall into all of this sort of negativity and self-destruction, you know? So I guess what I mean is maybe it's our responsibility to explain ourselves better and also to try and maybe make it so that more people could do these things because, you know, it is kind of very challenging for people at the moment, you know?
I feel exactly the same sentiments in the field of cybersecurity. This enormous weight, burden on my shoulders, responsibility to articulate and communicate the problems that to me are self-evident, which I know that the vast majority of people can't see, but they could see with maybe just a little bit of help. My fear is that even with that effort and education, you can't change these kinds of trajectories. It's like the human race is on a roller coaster and it's going to go into this dark place, you know, even if everybody knows. Yeah, I mean, it really weighs on me. It really weighs on me all the time. I look at every single device is kind of compromised out of the box right now. Every single service is hanging by a thread because it's just absolutely appallingly written code, really bad software engineering.
Yeah.
Everything seems like it's just days away from total collapse all of the time. And then you've got these massive big tech corporations just lying to people every day. And politicians who are just up to their necks in corruption with it as well, and uneducated and don't really understand. And it frightens me. But there's always been this. It seems like we're always on the brink of doom. But it doesn't happen, right? Because, you know, the human spirit is just somehow resilient to this. I don't think that people will accept where the gaslighters tell us we're supposed to be going. And I think, look at the Apple advert. Did you see the Apple advert the other day?
One that
was, and it was just so tone deaf and very badly received. And that idea that exists within a company like Apple, which is a mixture of reckless engineering, reckless social engineering, and overzealous anti-humanism. It's just unchecked. I mean,
You know, when I saw that, I said to someone in the chat that I think it's sort of emblematic of a certain ideology, a certain approach to life, which unfortunately I think is very, very common in tech founders and very common in tech bro type startup type developers, which is and what I would describe that as is really a Eric Frome would refer to as like this having mode of being. But also a very control-oriented existence, psychology. Yeah. So that they are about controlling everyone and kind of owning, crushing everyone. It's what it felt like. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, okay, it really, and you know, I have to say, I've seen some people from some of the AI automated music creativity startups. It almost felt like they were sort of bragging, well, you creative people have been doing this stuff for ages and now we crushed it. You said it was going to be hard and we crushed it, sort of thing. It was like a very much, you had your toys and they were all fun for you and you made royalties off that, which we were kind of jealous of.
Mm.
But now we made a system that can kind of crush that, so you can't have those toys anymore. That ad felt a bit similar to that to me.
I get that a lot of that reading like the Y Combinator kind of Hacker News forum.
Yeah.
Is that there is a very strong culture out there in the development community of people who delight in the social destruction that technology wreaks.
Yeah.
They love it. It's like, hey, look at what my toys can do. They can subtract value from almost every aspect of human life. And
it's this like sort of let everything burn. Let's burn everything down approach.
It's apocalyptic. And it kind of goes with that singularity thing. It goes with that kind of death drive towards the destruction of everything old, which will now be replaced with a new magical, it's religious. I mean, we know it is.
Yeah.
It's not even, I don't even call it quasi-religious anymore. It's a new religion, and tech has become a religion for those people, but also for a lot of other people, in a sense that, it's that cargo cult that they just worship.
I mean, I would kind of be okay with it from a kind of a sort of social and political perspective if there was a plan of what happens. But it's almost like there is no plan. It's just destruction.
It's nihilistic. And what's the word? Technological determinism. That's the deepest admission that there is no plan. It's an abdication of real control. It's an abdication of design. It's an abdication of engineering, because what you're saying is, don't worry, technology's got its own mind. It's got its own thing going on here. And we're just biological bits of meat that, we'll be wiped out by this, but it will triumph in the end. And, honestly, it's absolutely mentally ill. It's clinically insane. That, but it's big. It's huge. And it's part of the mindset of very rich and powerful people and politicians who follow them and believe that they're going to create wealth. And we know that they're not. They're going to cause chaos and civil unrest eventually.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, would you say then that this, because, I mean, this sounds like, as we talk about it, laissez-faire capitalism gone nuts, basically, is no different. It's just happening in technology. And in a way, I guess some people would say that that control, which was sort of sacrificed in the 80s to the banks, is now in tech.
Yeah, I mean, it's shifted there. The interesting, when you look at Meadows and Forrester and all the kind of systems analysts, built into every system are negative feedback components, which means that when it veers off too much in one direction, it self-regulates or collapses. And that's just an extreme form of self-regulation. But we're all so invested in technology now. We've made smartphones and online stuff be the sort of centre of existence, There's a sense in which we can't afford for it to collapse. But there's no resilience plan. There's no mitigation built in for the fact that this stuff is incredibly precarious and we are deliberately putting ourselves on a trajectory to make it all go horribly wrong. And we're ignoring the testimony of experts. We're ignoring the computer scientists. We're ignoring the systems theorists. We're ignoring the cybersecurity people. And I have this constant Cassandra feeling. I wake up every day and think, oh no, this is pointless. I can't do anything to stem the cracks in the dike.
Yeah, I mean, that is like, I think it's kind of my own project, which I'm trying to sort of find a way of making at the moment. The question it's trying to address is my own internal question, which is, how do I get up every day and live with that feeling of seeing the slow motion kind of collapse? Not just in the areas we're talking about now, but with climate change, what is happening socially in general, polarization and continuous, ridiculously amplified argument that is constantly going on.
I hear you. What Kate says to me, I'll say it while it's on my mind, is you have to embrace failure. What I mean by that is that, you know, history is written by the victors, and so what you read when you look at history is a biased account, a survivorship biased account of everything that ever happened. Whereas if you think about it, that maybe is like 1% of history, and the 99% of history was all the people who died, whose battles were not successful, whose inventions never came to fruition. You know, it's most of stuff is failure, and we're in a sort of epoch of, I guess, failure. But you can embrace that. There is dignity. Even when you look ahead and you think, well, we're fighting a losing battle, we're going to lose. But it's the action of getting up and doing something every day is the reason.
Fighting against the dying of the light.
It is that. It is absolutely that, yeah. And there's dignity in it. And,
yes, there is. And I can't subscribe to that really sort of Taoist Buddhist thing where you're like, well, I'm outside of it. I'm in the moment. I'm not thinking about what could happen. I'm not thinking about the past. I'm just existing in this beautiful moment, and I don't have a responsibility to change it. Like, I think that's a dangerous slope to kind of start slipping down.
Yeah, into that kind of abdication of all action and responsibility.
All responsibility,
saying,
yeah.
Well, it's beyond me, and so therefore it's not worth doing anything. No, the fun is in doing your tiny little bit of stuff in protest, swimming against the tide, despite everything else that's going on, and finding meaning and dignity in that.
Exactly. I mean, it is kind of like another one, back to the doom again, is that there was someone on Twitter the other day that summed up what I've been thinking about a bit with AI on a big cultural level, is this idea that these big models now are like information destroyers, which was a really good way of saying what I kind of had a feeling about. So his example was that if you had a large language model looking at Hamlet, for instance, and then it was just kind of, it was predicting the next token, you know, of Hamlet, you say, tell me Hamlet, and it would do it, and then it would hallucinate every now and again, and a little bit would get polluted out into the internet, which was effectively a slightly shittier Hamlet. And then that would just continuously go out. In a couple of years, OpenAI would be training off the internet again, which is now polluted with this slightly shittier version of Hamlet. And then it just gets shittier and shittier and shittier until it's just this sort of swamp that is basically not human knowledge anymore.
The analogy that I use is bovine spongiform encephalopathy, BSE, mad cow disease. And that happens in a system where you take the waste products of the output and you render them down and you feed them back into the living system. So that kind of came
AI in BSE.
It is that. I mean, what's happening is you took the bone meal, wasn't it? It was the rendered down bones of cattle, and you fed that as feed to the cattle. What happens in a positive feedback system like that is, because it's selective and you don't know what it's going to select for, it turned out that in that case it selected for prions, which are these like kind of weird proteins that cause diseases. But generally, when you get a system and you put it into positive feedback like that, what it selects for will eventually be something very destructive. Right, so we might get out of AI is just like the ultimate malware machine.
That's very interesting. I did think about that once with feedback systems, you know, with say biometric feedback with music. Imagine a thought experiment. You made a completely personalized sort of real-time music system that was responding to loads of biometrics that this person would be plugged into as they were experiencing it, and it would be constantly positively optimizing to their biometric response. You'd kind of tune this thing to the point where, you know, they were having like sort of frisson every 2 seconds, and then, you know, reaching sort of climactic levels of emotional excitement and becoming completely addicted to it. And, you know, it's quite a sort of Philip K. Dick sort of thing, but like, in a sense, you know, if you think about positive feedback, which could be potentially done for benign reasons initially, even something like music, where we always say nobody dies, maybe in that scenario it's even dangerous, you know, I mean, I think it's clearly doesn't make sense to just do this approach, which is I'm just going to burn everything down and just do stuff because I can.
Yeah.
You know.
And Edward Snowden said this, and I've said this for years as well, just because you can doesn't mean that you should. And
exactly.
I think there is a kind of thing going on where people see a frontier and, well, I can, so I will. And there's absolutely no reflection. And that's where my whole project of trying to write ethics for hackers comes from, which is now in its third year or fourth year perhaps, and it's getting more and more difficult to write. It's a project that's constantly escaping me, because every time I think I've got the structure nailed down and written some chapters, something else comes along that just puts everything into a completely different light.
Well, the acceleration of the scale of ethical deficit is getting so astounding, like, for me. Yeah, it's like that feels like that is on a real hockey stick curve.
It is, isn't it? And you encounter a new piece of technology and you kind of read the narrative around it, and it's like I said, it's the people taking delight in the malfeasance of it. It's like, it's not new tech unless it's terrifying. Do you remember, and that slide deck I had was creepy is the new cool, and
yeah.
That people kind of vibing off it, they said I feel really uncomfortable about this, but there's actually something about it I like, and it's this kind of death drive Thanatos thing going on behind it. Yeah, it's more than just a lack of ethics. It's a positive celebration of the horror within technology.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
What we did in that company, it was culturally successful. Yeah, it has resonated through a lot of different projects. You know, projects like Inception or Dimensions, the one afterwards, and some of the early scenes. I've spoken to so many people that are doing projects now in VR and AR and especially augmented reality, and people doing different things with audio in huge companies that knew all of these projects. So it's interesting to think about success in those terms, because...
I'm glad you say that, Rob, because in my heart, I do know that. I know that we were successful artists. I know that we moved culture. When you ride on that wave of being 10 years ahead of what everybody else is doing, you don't get the commercial successes. And you can't expect them, because it's, you know, it's the second mouse that gets the cheese.
It's kind of like, you know, I say, oh, you're doing this, I'm consulting on something or whatever. And then I say, oh, you know, I was at this company, RJDJ, and we did this thing. And they go, holy shit, you made that. Like, it is like, some of the projects are like cult projects now. So especially Inception, really, because that was, you know, it's one of the few apps I've ever seen. It had technical debt, so it didn't work anymore as iOS was updated, or they didn't update it. But it was so successful, and so many people wanted it that were writing to company all the time, that they reworked the whole app and got it working again.
Wow.
In the App Store 5 years after it was released.
Wow.
So I've never seen that happen, you know, really, to any other audio projects. All of them, they just come and go, yeah.
But we had some purchase there in that.
Yeah.
I mean, culturally for a while. It's good. I'm very proud of the stuff that we did together. And I also have matured in how I see the things that Michael did, which I was probably pretty critical of at the time. And now I can kind of understand, like, the venture capital and the pressures that he was in to make those choices. I just look at it now as the most amazing bit of fun. You know, we had so much fun then. And it was just really amazing to be part of that. But the thing is that the world moves on, and we do too. But we you know, in a sense, we're doing the same thing. We're doing more of the same thing. Do you know what a conversation that comes back to me was when we had Martin? Do you remember Martin Ware when he came in? And I was a little bit starstruck, because I'm like a really big Human League fan, and I was like, oh, can't tell me something cool. And he kept going on about the Black Kit of Space, which was a really cool Human League record, right? It was the Black Kit of Space sucking in the human race. And there's that bit where he goes, I reached for the arm, which was less than 1 micron long, but weighed more than Saturn, and time stood still. And every time I tried to flee, the record was in front of me. And I kind of recited the lyrics back, and he looked at me like, I can't remember that. But like, and I think of that, and that's AI. You know, that is AI now. It's the incredible super success of something. Where something can be successful, but it can be too successful. It can be so successful that it's a catastrophe, if you know what I mean. And that song lyric just kind of captured what's happening with AI. It's an incredible success, isn't it? In fact, that line is in The Matrix, I think, in Agent Smith saying that it was the moment at which humanity was reveling in its success. And
well, yeah, although, I mean, it comes again, like, what does success mean, you know? Mm. It's like, in that sense, in this sense, when we talk about AI, I think it's not successful. It's not positive, yeah? It's potentially massively destructive, not in the Terminator way, in a much more insidious way, which is kind of like we were saying, information destruction, skill destruction, all of these types of potential longer-term impacts. Maybe it is successful. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, what I was going to say is that when I was in school and, you know, we were just getting taught all of this stuff. We were getting taught knowledge by rote, you know. And I was like, hang on, this doesn't make any sense. Like, why is learning all this stuff beneficial? Why is this other kid over there that I know I can sense isn't really thinking very well, isn't thinking very clearly, why are they getting an A? Because they learned a load of stuff by rote.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that useful for everyone, you know? Then you get to the internet, and I remember, like, great guy, really hardworking, but he was from the he's from a different generation to me, and a generation that grew up with the internet kind of thing, where everything was on hand. Everything, if you want to learn something, your knowing something had no currency anymore, because anyone to a certain extent could go and learn anything they wanted. But now AI's got us to this point where knowledge is sort of meaningless, in the sense that it's sort of, or skills even become meaningless. So you get to this point where, meaningless is the wrong word, because they can have immense meaning, the practice and the
It's not as socially useful anymore.
Is yeah. It's maybe not socially required anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that it may definitely, you know, it could definitely not have such economic power as it used to have.
Does that mean that maybe it becomes more valuable, but in a different sphere? You know, that suddenly things that of human value move outside of the sphere of economics, and that in a sense is an antidote to capital.
Well, potentially, I don't know. I don't think we know that. And that's the most scary thing, is that we don't, in a post AI world, we don't know what is valuable. Maybe that's the most scary thing.
That's a very good comment. I like that. Value sort of loses its meaning.
Maybe the only thing that I feel very good about, and what I was kind of getting around to, I think, is that maybe AI is successful at forcing us to think about what is it that we are good at that these systems are not good at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if I view a large language model, really, in my interactions with it, as a curiosity about an intelligence, but I don't think of it as intelligence. I think about it as an incredibly strange and new form of search, really. It's sort of searching human knowledge, but in this very bespoke, specific way that is synthesizing that search into something very special that it thinks that I want. I think that's a very different thing to intelligence, really, although this gets into philosophy. But in that sense, maybe it's successful, going back to success, maybe its success is that it just sort of offloads a whole load of that stuff, and it will kind of force us to be focusing on what we are doing.
Helps us see a bigger picture, perhaps.
Yeah, we realize maybe that our imagination, our ability to theorize and see beyond any corpus information that we're exposed to is what is important about humanity, what's important about what we do. So maybe that is successful, but it's quite a painful way to get there.
It is, and I think, well, what's the collateral damage? Who are the big casualties? When you have transformations like that, they tend to be for the few. The existing elites will amplify, the existing academics and so on. And the average person tends to end up being the ones that pay for that in some way. And we can see that in the enormous transfer of intellectual property, although I hate that term, but the hoovering up of content. I actually think that, and it's not just AI, it's the whole data industrial complex, the whole surveillance capitalism and the mass surveillance through apps and so on. The greatest transfer of human wealth in history ever has taken place in the last decade, but it's been almost invisible. All of that wealth has gone from the many to the few. And AI is a way of concentrating and banking that into very small, compressed nuggets of, you know, distilled humanity.
Yeah.
I mean, you can then sell back to humanity the way that the Paper Street soap company sells back, you know, human fat to the rich.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm most worried about is that the same thing will happen with AI that happened with social media, which is that we, as a society in the big picture, we're not aware of what is going on in the construction of these systems and how they were made and what the potential impacts were. We weren't aware enough early enough. Hmm. So that, and by the time we were aware, they were so entrenched into society that they were, you know, inextricably embedded. No one can work out a way of getting them out again. Even the people that want to get them out also need to rely on them and use them mainly from an economic perspective, and also probably because they're emotionally and psychologically addicted to them.
Yeah.
So what I worry about the most with AI is that they will pull off the same trick again, and it gets to the point where these systems have, and I wouldn't say really successful functionality, because I think they will do some things good enough that will become very useful. I'm not so sure it will necessarily improve the world, but it could be very useful for some people, to the point where it becomes inextricable.
They're a crutch. We'll lean on them and make them a dependency. You know, and I don't necessarily think that that's a conscious trick. I think that's a process that's inherent to all technologies. Is you know, they start out as something separate from current praxis, and event you turn around and you don't realise that you've absolutely integrated them.
Yeah, but I think Cory Doctorow wouldn't agree though with that, because his shitification is like consciously, deliberately doing that with a view to dominating a market and fully entrenching a system into it, and then
it's a cynically leveraging that dependency once it's happened. But I think the process by which you get to dependency is quite organic, you know, capital's seen that as another opportunity. Okay, now we can really, really lean on these people because they're stuck with it. I won't even talk about writing this in Digital Vegan like almost 10 years ago or whatever, because there's no point. And other people were writing it 50 years before me. I mean, Lewis Mumford and Jacques Ellul and you know, and even going back to Martin Heidegger and people like that, they could see the rough edges of how technology works in society and how the two go together. AI is very, very dangerous in that regard. It's just so seductive. It just seems so so convenient and easy. And there's almost nobody I know who doesn't use it in some way. And as soon as they get a taste of it, it's like crack. It's like fentanyl. They're just like, okay, great. I'm an addict to this for life now. How much are you using AI in your current practice now?
Well, what's interesting for me is that the only time I think I ever have used a large language model and found it really useful, I was tweaking my bio for someone, and I just pasted my bio in there, said, make this better or something. And what was interesting is that it gave me an emotional perspective on myself, which I couldn't reach.
Wow, okay.
Because I was too inhibited about my own kind of promoting my own myself, mm-hmm. basically, mm-hmm. in a way that, because it had trained on, kind of absorbed the techniques of puffed up writing from so it was that perspective. Of course, you know, I could easily have got that from somebody, But what was interesting, it wasn't really the language or what it actually did or the writing that was interesting, is that it gave me a different emotional perspective. But in music, to be honest, it's become less and less interesting for me, and machine learning in general has become less and less interesting as it's become better, or in some ways almost like, you know, overfitting to its result very, very successfully.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I get that.
Because in creativity, I think a real creative is interested more in the flaws, bizarre failures.
Yes, exactly. Now, you're really getting into some good stuff now here, because I really get that. And I wondered whether you had too, and clearly you do, yeah.
Yeah, so for instance, one good example of that is in the project I did with the LA Phil. We used machine learning, which was trained on the entire recorded history of the LA Philharmonic, which is 100 years. It was for their centenary. And so we were working, you know, I was working with machine learning researchers, and we were working on that. We had algorithms that I was working with, Parag Mittal, actually, machine learning engineer, training various, so symbolic representations of different compositional bits, mm-hmm. from different composers.
Very interesting.
And we were training, so the beginning of the Rite of Spring is in this piece that we did with them, and then we let it hallucinate after a certain point and just try all kinds of different things. And you know, this is a long time ago now, it's 5 years ago, something like that, that's, you know, lifetimes in AI development now, but it was actually more interesting for me then, because that thing was creating all kinds of crazy nonsense after the moment when we said, that's all you're getting, and it had to carry on. And the one that, you know, as I was working with it, I chose one of those to work with and, you know, incorporate into stuff that I was doing with that afterwards, was just completely bizarre. It was something that, you know, it was not Stravinsky-ish at all. It was totally weird, chromatic, odd melody. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm sort of synthesizing that with some other aspect of like an harmonic algorithm I think we had that was about the chord progressions in Mahler, going into this Mahler piece that we used a recording of for the end of the piece. And, you know, so then I have these disparate elements that are coming from machine learning as a stimulating process, really, for me as an artist, and pushing me into very weird spaces. I see Rafiq Anadol, the visual artist who is involved in the project, who is basically making this massive, enormous projection over the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles, which is, mm-hmm. I mean, when I was standing in front of that, I was really awestruck with like the scale of this thing. But when I was reacting to the pre-visualizations of that were these, you know, enormous sort of particle system things that are like wrapping around the facade of that, which is in itself a completely bizarre building. So then I was thinking about, this needs to all be in kind of slow motion. So I'm like stretching out all of that input that's coming from the machine learning models, and then doing lots of my own composition in there. So it's like a, you know, who the hell is the composer of this thing? It's like Stravinsky. It's some kind of quite crappy symbolic machine learning model that is, you know, early stages compared to where we are now. Bits of Mahler in there, bits of me, all kinds of stuff. That's interesting to me, yeah, is taking these technological approaches and then just pushing artists into really crazy directions with what they're doing and coming up with something that was, you know, it was like really emotionally powerful.
So here's our first piece, a collaboration between Rob Thomas, Kermin Karaglu, the LA Philharmonic Orchestra, and many other artists. It's based on an AI-assisted compositional transform between the stars of Stravinsky and Mahler.
So that area of AI for me is like super interesting. But me typing a prompt into Suno or Udio and getting some generic pop song out of it to some nonsense lyrics, which I've thought about for 2 minutes, is not, I mean, it's funny. It can be really funny. I sent one to a friend of mine and it was like funny for 10 minutes and then, you know, that's it.
Yeah, sure.
So it's this unbelievable technical achievement that we've basically built and pumped. Every time we do it, we pump like a ton of carbon into the atmosphere to make some nonsense meme thing that is built off the entire recorded history of music to make basically a kind of fart joke or something, effectively the cultural equivalent of that. That's what it feels like, you know.
What you're describing is this enormous dynamic range between the most base, vulgar kind of uses and the peak of artistic fusion and synthesis and cooperation and plurality. You know, I can hear you describing two incredible extremes there.
I think that's what's very sad to me, though, really, because the opportunity for that peak of exploration and augmentation of human creativity is not really being explored at the moment. What we're doing first is automating human creativity.
Yeah, but that's where the money is. I mean, I think these sorts of projects that you're describing now will always be for the few. They will be for people like you and I and the artists that we talked about earlier. You know, they're not going to make money. They're not going to sell apps on phones. And that's as far as capital can see. You know, it's very short range. And that's where the majority of the effort is going to go. And I think we have to brace for that. I think we have to brace for an enormous dumbing down of many parts of art. I'm not sure what that means, really.
Well, I think saying that they're not going to make money is also down to what do we want. If we are relying on big companies making them make money, then I think that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think we, as artists and technologists, have to try and do it, basically. And for it to have scale and for it to have a chance of having enough exploration in these areas, it could be successful. There has to be a lot of it going on. So there has to be ways that we can make that more accessible to people who are less technical.
Okay, so we're kind of coming back to kind of get the circle connected now, and probably getting towards time for wrapping up. So what I'd like to do, Rob, is to put you on the spot and say, how are we going to make AI in music be a success for everybody? How are we going to get the best? Let's put the doom aside and imagine a beautiful, bright future in which AI has this role alongside human creativity, an infusion in symbiosis and synthesis with it somehow. What would that look like?
Well, I think it's not necessarily just AI, but all technical tools of making music. I think we should be creating those tools so they are embedded in the human creative process and extending that. So I think that will happen, and there is work that's going on in those areas. So for instance, extending what you do in a DAW to enable you to do way more in a shorter period of time by using AI processes to automate aspects of that, which, you know, it's been happening a long time in mixing and mastering, but now I think is something that is really starting to take hold in composition as well. So I think that will happen, yeah. And in order for that to be positive and not destructive, that needs to enable, I think, more originality and more, or rather lack of homogeneity and genericism in output. It comes back to what AI needs. So, you know, AI to be successful, machine learning needs all of the compute and all of the algorithms and all of that kind of stuff. But it needs a massive amount of examples of well-labeled good examples of what it's trying to achieve.
But isn't that the thing that scares everybody the most, in that like you're creating this insatiable beast that needs to feed on humanity, and it won't be satisfied by anything but the prime good cuts from the most creative people? And if you feed it back to itself, then it turns into a monster.
Yeah.
How do we sustain something like that? Or is it ever done? Well, is there a day when someone says, you know what, we've programmed, we've trained our AIs and they've absorbed all of human wisdom and knowledge as far as we can tell. And so from here on, now that's it. Yeah, that's...
Well, no, I would never say that. I would say that we just need to do things that are not so easy for it to ingest and for it to imitate.
Okay, so, okay. I'm really interested in this. Let me just see if I can clarify this and maybe help other people get it. We've worked on this reactive music and this fringe type of music, which I've always called as having deferred form, meaning that as a composition, as a creation, it's deliberately incomplete, and the parameters to complete it happen in the moment. They happen at the point of delivery when you play it, and that sort of general model for what I also call procedural audio and stuff. But from an artistic point of view, that is something that the listener, the user, the end, it sort of interacts with it, and they supply sort of the missing ingredient and so on, which you've called non-linear music earlier on. And but what you're hinting at now is that we want music to be in this kind of a new form, which means that by its very nature of being in deferred form, it can't be ingested by an AI.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go as far to say as it can't be, because I wouldn't underestimate where we might go with AI. But I would say it might be more difficult. What I would say is that what we've done with recorded music is very easy.
Evidently, you know? Yeah.
And I would say that that is the result of a stagnation of innovation in recorded music for the last 20, 30 years.
Well, the culture ossifies as it goes along, doesn't it? So what happens is you get these, that you've always got the kind of cutting edge. On the avant-garde, no one really knows what to call it, but then it becomes rap or R&B or jazz or whatever. And then it's easy to tag, it's easy to label. So historically, you can mine, you can go backwards in time mining things, and it's very well described. It's got good descriptors on it, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess what I'm advocating for is not to do reactive music or to do adaptive music or any of these different ways that we're describing things that go beyond recording, but just to go beyond recording in some way, to do something. And in fact, I think it would be more successful, more individual, and more differentiating against, first of all of human music, which is completely saturated already anyway, regardless of AI. We were, before 2024, there was way too much music to listen to anyway. But now there's going to be like orders of magnitude more produced, orders of magnitude cheaper by AI. So in many ways, you know, this is a trend that's been going on for a very long time, which has just been accelerated to zero, sort of thing. And I would say that the more individual things are that people do with music in the recorded domain, or in other areas as well. I mean, you know, it's always been the case in live, but in recorded music specifically, because in the distributed form, you know, you're trying to give an experience where you're not there. You're trying to create some unique experience for people, which you can't be there to give them. So I would, yeah, I'd say that the more unique it is and the more unusual it is, the better, really. And I'm not really kind of advocating for any particular direction of travel. I think that some of the things that we've explored and some of the other areas of ways that people have gone beyond recording with music technology are really interesting. But like I said, we've hardly done anything. There's a handful of people on the planet that have really done it, and there needs to be many, many more people doing that for us to make progress. The reason why I think it needs to do that, and we have to make the tools to do that, is to get it beyond what you said, which is like this small group of people that have explored it, and it's kind of a fringe. It amazes people when we do these types of projects, and they are. You know, I mean, I'm very lucky in that, like, my work is because I've done lots of those projects. That's why I get to do those projects. And when people are experiencing these types of things, they're very excited by them.
I still find that now, you know. I mean, I hear you saying that what should happen is that the stuff that we were doing, like, 15 years ago, we should kind of figure out that should go mainstream now.
Well, I guess what I mean is that it's okay It may be the reckoning that comes out of this sort of crisis of that we, if AI forces a kind of reckoning creatively, is you know, well, what we did with recorded music and what we did by making albums and singles and things, if AI can do that now, if something can train on that and not, I mean, I don't think we're there yet with AI. I don't think it's doing, you know, Sergeant Pepper's, but it's sort of kind of getting closer and closer all of the time. If AI can do that, then maybe we need to be doing something else.
We do, yeah. I mean, that's a natural progression of art, is that it has to move into a new space because it gets consolidated and the world catches up with it constantly.
And I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, you know, for the arts. I think it's a painful thing. It does make me very sad that this has happened in many ways. I've actively avoided being involved in any way with this trajectory over the years. I think some people are almost want it. They want to burn it all down.
They do. We talked about that. They're wishing it upon themselves. But yeah, hey, you're saying that the coming of AI is a wake-up call for artists, and in a way we should celebrate that, and we should rise to the challenge and figure out completely new forms which are just pushing way past the paradigm of recorded music.
Because there's so much exciting stuff to do. It is hard. Yeah, at the moment it's very hard because the tools are not there, but we need to make those tools to be much, much better than they are now. But there's so many exciting things to do with music.
There is. Well, Rob, you're going to absolutely blow the minds of everybody at Music Hackspace, and I think you've probably blown the minds of our Cyber Show listeners as well. the enthusiasm never goes. It's so great to chat with you.